Session number 13420.
Mr. Mulgrew 3. The cousin, his name was Fisher, Horace Fisher. And I gather that he was the first tank to get to the top of Mont Pinçon, and that his tank commander was a member of the Johnny Walker family. That's just as an aside, of course.
But when you went into the line the second time, was it just as bad as the first?
It was patchy. There was never any concerted, as I saw, tank for tank warfare. It was patchy. We seemed to get quite a lot of casualties with bazookas, the German bazookas.
The Panzerfaust.
Yes, yes. And whilst this surge was on to Mont Pinçon, we ourselves were aiming down for Conde Sunorio, I think the name was, and then hopefully to Argentan, where, as one knows, the pincer was closed on the Falaise Gap. Now that in itself was a bit hairy. Those RAF lads I shall be forever grateful for, particularly the Typhoon pilots. I'm not ashamed to say it, I've shed tears with joy when I see them. We had a cab rack, I think it was called, a flight of three Tiffy's Typhoons on the same radio frequency as us. And they would be just toozing about, waiting to be called on. Now, for example, there'd be a Tiger about 2,000 yards in front, dug in, and all you could, it was to all effect an iron pillbox because the hull was completely covered, and that could be holding up the whole advance. So the infantry would crawl forward as near as possible and throw yellow smoke. Then our squadron leader would, hello Abel 6-3, message for Abel, or Abel, message for Abel 6-3. German tank, map reference, so-and-so. And back would come the reply, OK, Abel, Roger, Wilco, and you'd look up and you'd see these lads just slip away and disappear into the distance. Now, we had a 12-foot aerial on the top of our tank, and you thought that almost they were going to knock this aerial off. They were so low. And they would come in at 0 feet and fire these rockets, and the power of those rockets, the recoil was such you could even see the aircraft go back slightly. But the damage that those things caused was, it was beyond belief. I mean, you'd suddenly see a flash and the whole tank would disappear. Now, as I say, nobody will ever hear me call an RAF bloke a brilliant boy, never. So so much for that.
Can you tell me which places you went through in Normandy? What was the kind of geographical path that you took?
Going on, obviously I can't remember everything, but for example, when we got to the Seine at Vernon, we were the first tanks across. We had to wait till they built this Bailey Bridge. And there'd been skirmishes with the odd tank, Lieutenant Trusenster, Reg Cox, I remember. And but they got this bridge across, and we went across, and then we went through places like Legel, Vegel, Bouvet, Lille. We liberated Lille.
What was the liberation of Lille like?
Oh, that was tremendous, tremendous. They hadn't quite made it an open city, but we went in fairly swift. And, of course, in no time at all, from not seeing a soul in the street, ah, les Anglais, les Anglais. And, of course, then everything was great. Pulling you out of the tank, showering you with gifts, champagne, wine. And it was getting to the state that we thought we were going to stay there for the evening. But by this time, the commanding officer had decreed that We were in Norfolk State to fight a war. So
because
we
you're in an alcoholic haze.
Indeed. So we had to draw back, or go forward, sorry, to the, you know, to the far end before we stopped. But that was a memorable occasion. And now we've links with Lille, and I gather that our regimental, or a regimental flag, flies occasionally from the town hall. There was an instance where it was reported that there was a Tiger tank down the side street, and so the chappie called Sergeant Driffield, he was in a 17-pounder, he inched his way forward, and fortunately the gun was of the Tiger was facing t'other way, and so he was able to pull up alongside and ram 3 17-pounders up his tail, which gave him considerable pleasure, as you can imagine. And ironically, there was a Frenchman there who whipped out a wheelbarrow and took the 17-pounder shell cases as souvenirs. And then, and of course, the B squadron round Tournai, I think it was, or near Beauvais, there were some SS chappies counterattacked, and they caught the B echelon, the soft vehicles with the supplies. And we must have lost about 30 lorries and with quite a few chaps taken prisoner. The RSM, 2 or 3 sergeant majors, and that was a bit of a blow, as you could imagine. And then from there we moved up to, we crossed over into Belgium at Gaarsberg, and that was the point I remember. And then we were detailed to go and attack Leopoldsburg. We were coming under the jurisdiction of the Guards Armour Division then. So we were in a line, and my troop was detailed to go forward to see if it was still held. And it was open terrain, and the edge of the town of Leopoldsburg, long hedges and trees. And there were two of the tanks out, far out on the right. And we were there in a hold-down position, just observing, inching our way forward. And from somewhere, there was an anti-tank gun that hit the two tanks outside, in the distance there. One or two wounded, Ray Sparrow, bless him, from Salisbury, driver, he got killed. Corporal Priddle of the Isle of Wight, he lost a foot. The others got away. It was evening time, and it was so difficult just to, looking through your periscope to detect anything. We couldn't see any movement. But, I mean, that thing must have just had its nose protruding through this low hedge, and then it disappeared, because we never saw a thing. Anyway, we reported back, and the following morning, the 13th, 18th, they came around the other side, and they came in, and so we joined up, and we took it between us. Now, that action was followed by 3 or 4 days in civvy billets, just relaxing. With the tanks, you were doing your D&M, your maintenance, cleaning the guns and the like. Because we were then going with the Guards Armour Div up Club Route, known as Eld Highway, aiming for Arnhem from there. Whilst we'd been scrapping for Burg Leopold, the Guards Armour Div had moved to the right, and they'd taken Hechtel, and their objective was Brussels. And the 11th Armoured, they were going up to the left to take Antwerp, leaving this middle prong clear, you see. Well, we set off from there, joshing backwards and forwards, in front of each other. And finally, we linked up with 82nd Airborne, I think it was at Grave Bridge. From there, we moved up and lagered just outside Nijmegen. The guards had come through and taken the bridge, the Irish guards. And how that those tanks got across that bridge, I shall never know. Because when we went over and looked back and to see these 75 and 88 anti-tank guns pointing straight across the bridge, that was quite something. When we went over, the German infantry, they were still strapped in the stanchions of the bridge.
You mean the dead bodies?
Yeah. And as we turned left off the bridge to go down through Oosterhout, all the bank side of the river were German bodies. They'd really caught a cold from the tanks lined up at Nijmegen firing across the water, coupled with the artillery shells. I mean, they looked like lots and lots of pepper pots. There's so many holes there. Now, the guards, for some reason or other, had got stuck at a place called Elst, E-L-S-T. We were doing a night drive from Oosterhout. B Squadron actually got up to drill that night, which is on the bank of the Rhine, linking up with the Polish airborne. We were hammering up behind them. Now, in my case, my driver was following two lights, the tail lights of the tank in front, and we were on one of these dikes with a drop of either side. Now, suddenly, he could only see one. And in the dark, he thought it was turning. It was turning. But in point of fact, we found out later that that bulb had fused. And we went straight over the top of this dike and rolled some 20 feet in the tank, landing upside down on its turret. The driver and co-driver were able to escape because of the escape hatch in their compartment. But George Ackrill, the gunner, myself, and the current commander was a chappy called Sergeant Harris, a regular soldier who got the MM at Dunkirk. We were trapped, and water was beginning to come up. And he sat there with his revolver. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going to shoot myself rather than drown." "Oh, thanks very much." Well, fortunately, on its turret, and the turret being countersunk into the body of the hull, with it being upside down and the weight of the hull, he started to settle. And in so doing, the turret, it began to swing on the turret. Round the inside of the turret were little gaps from the wire where we could reach through and get the ammunition and that. And we were watching that gap slowly widen and widen and widen until Harry said, "Go on, Molly, you're the tallest. So, taking a breath, you're actually into the water and getting through into the compartment. Stand smart, the driver, he's pulling, I'm being pushed from behind, and of course my body is shaped only halfway the right way. So the rest of the body, around the legs and the thighs, it just felt as if somebody was cutting him up with a knife. And I was bloodied up there. But we got away. And the following morning, that same night, of course, we felt naked. There were Spandau's firing away, and fortunately the squadron leader sensed that there's something wrong, and so he sent a half track back, and we were able to go up and rejoin the squadron that were lagered for the night. The following day, they got stuck in, although by this time we'd gone back for another tank. The squadron went in and they captured Elst, which was quite something. And even to this day, there's a monument in the square at Elst in front of the town hall, which pays tribute to the boys of the 43rd Division and the 4th 7th Royal Dragoon Guards. We stayed on the island until late November.
And just then, in fixed positions?
Pardon?
Just in fixed positions?
Yes. We were holding the line. You could see Arnhem in the distance. We were holding the line with the 101st American Airborne, the Screaming Eagle boys. And they were finally relieved by Canadians. But we were drawn back down to Brunsum, the promise of Lindbergh. And we had to find our own billet, which was quite a change, though, to be living in... I mean, I hadn't slept in a bed since my last leave. And to get into a bed, white sheets, have a bath, it was paradise. Our next venture from there, we was in the Battle of Geilenkirchen. This was whilst we were based in Brunsum. We took off. And names like Gilrath, Dritzrath, all spring readily to mind. But what an area it was.
What was this battle? What was this battle?
The Battle for Geilenkirchen. And I felt so sorry for the infantry. There were 102 shells an hour dropping in that area. And it was heaving with rain. It was an absolute bog.
What did your unit have to do in that battle?
Just go as far as we could get. Each squadron had an objective, albeit Trippsrath, Gilrath, Geilenkirchen itself. Now, when you got that object, you stayed put until told to do something else.
According to your notes here, this was in early December.
Well, as I said, it was late November when we went down. Then the time that elapsed, then we went in there, yes.
Is Geilenkirchen in Germany? Or
yes,
in...
just over the border. Actually, this was where I'd gone looking for my cousin, and that was when I found out that he'd been killed. That was rather upsetting, as you could imagine. So then we came back into Brunsum, stood to, then we moved out to a place called Schimmert. Where we had Christmas Day. This was a little village, about 5 kilometres out of Brunsum. We had Christmas Day, where the officers dutifully brought us a pint of beer, and we ate in a barn. The cooks had been at it all night, bless them. Can we give us a Christmas meal? And it was terribly cold, frosty, snowy. And on New Year's Day, we were doing a static wireless scheme in this orchard when we were given a bit of a bouncing by the German Air Force, because this was when the Battle of the Ardennes was taking off, and they were trying to get across to Brussels and Antwerp and so on.
Can you describe what you saw of the German Air Force on that day?
No, we were very... we just kept our head down. And then...
Where was this?
This was in Schimmert, this little village where we were.
Schimmert?
Schimmert, Schimmert. Schimmert. And then I was one of the fortunate ones that was given home leave. My name came out of the hat fairly quickly. So it took us 24 hours to get on the train down to Calais. That was ghastly. Clapped out train, no windows, sheets, blankets at the windows to keep the snow out. Enjoyed the hot, and as you can imagine, I enjoyed the leave. And I arrived back just in time to be told, don't bother going for your kit, just throw what you've got on the tank. Because we were going to do a night attack on Heinsberg. The idea was that the 7th Armoured were going straight up the Axis, and we would branch off to the right to form a two-pronged attack, which would be seized at the Ruhr River. We'd have a pocket of Germans there, and then there were the Canadians coming up from the south, mopping up en route. Now, I had brought a bottle of whiskey, two bottles of rum for the crew from home. We had our serge uniform, denims, zoot suits. These were the special suits that were zipped up and you'd have, and a cowl and what have you, and the overcoat on top of that. As we moved off, it was so cold that during the night we drank all the bottles that I had brought, plus an accumulated rum ration. It was the bitterest night that I've ever known in my life. Your fingers were sticking to the guns, and the whole night was fairly light because of this knack of the searchlights to make it look like moonlight, and that was showing us the way. Now, we knew there were Germans in the ditches because they had tiller mines on rope and kept pulling these across, which halted us. I mean, we could see them, so we had to make sure, blow them off and what have you. Now, we lost one tank that night, and it was something like 9-10 miles of a drive. I think it was the 13th, 18th, who came up the following morning on the same axis, and they lost 11 tanks with anti-tank guns that were in the area. But because we'd gone through at night, we were fortunate. So that's just another of the memories.
Where were you heading for?
Hochheide, Heinsberg, in that area.
And this was January, was it?
Yeah.
Did you get to Hochheide?
Oh, yes, with the aid of flamethrowers.
Did you have flamethrowers on your tank?
No, these were REs.
Any other memories of the attack on Hochheide?
Only in this sense that when we finally stood down and we camouflaged, there's a laddie on guard, and his tank was parked right up against a wooden barn, and the vibration had upset the footings there, and the whole thing collapsed right on top of this barn. So you can imagine the feeling of this young man as he stood there in the dead of night, wondering what happened when the roof fell in. But that is about it. Because from then on we moved on. Now where did we go to from there? Oh, yeah. We moved back up towards Nijmegen then. And we were lagered in the area around Muck, which is southeast of Nijmegen. Our next move was going to be the attack into the Reichswald. Our brief was that we would be shooting in the infantry of the 51st Island Division with others. Now, this turned out to be that on the 8th of February, this was when all this lot started. If you could imagine the scene, there were over 1,000 guns poised. There were Bren guns in the bottom, there were Vickers guns behind them. Both was behind them. There was the whole brigade of tanks. That would be what? 61 three times. That's 183 tanks. You had the 25-pounders, the 5.5, the 7.2s and the 9.2s, all stacked up like the manuals of an organ. It was a moonlight night, it was crisp. And round about 4:20, out there in the forest, suddenly there was a piper started playing a dirge with his foot on a log. It made my hair stand on the back of my neck, and he was on my side. I don't know what the Germans felt like just over the other side in the forest.